Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Morning. We have two cases left on our 9 o'clock docket to be argued and one on the 10:30. We understand counsel in the two cases on the 9 o'clock docket have announced ready, so we'll call the first case in the interest of RCM, SRM, and JWM, and N. Ray Scott Miles.
Good morning. We're here today on one of those cases that I seem to get. Case 8 years alleged of no child support payment. They come forward and allege 431 non-payments. As we get to see after the fact in this case, my client was finally able to obtain affidavits of business records, of bank records, and various documents, some of which were found, unfortunately, in the basement of her mother in Denver, Colorado. Sometimes bad facts give rise to difficult issues of law to decide, and I think the fundamental first issue that the court has to address is the situation in which the case was dismissed and never reinstated. I think the issue that the court's going to be grappling with this morning are the leading cases by the Texas Supreme Court, which we cited, of Walker versus Harrison and the others, and also we cited to the court to N. Ray Montemayor, Court of Appeals case, which once a case has been dismissed, the only way it can be reinstated is by a written order, which must be express and specific. I did do searches to see if you could reinstate by implication and things like that. I really couldn't come anything up to put my hands on something like that. I think the closest thing, and that's what the appellees brought forward, was when you've got the two judgment rule. Which judgment controls? Of course, in that situation, that does not deal with when a case has actually been dismissed. So I think those are distinguishable along those lines. What we do have...
Well, what would be the reason why, just the fact that it's a dismissal versus another type, is there something more?
I think so. I think so. I think the difference, Your Honor, is the difference between having two judgments, one of which ones you're deciding which one has priority, is the additional requirement in the Rules of Civil Procedure on the way a case is reinstated, cited to the court, 165, very specific requirements, elements, a hearing, a finding. And then the Supreme Court dictates about that it's got to be in a written order. It has to be express and specific, saying we're reinstating the case. So I think primarily that's the issue for the court to grapple with, and I think that's pretty much the distinction of these additional elements. Because what happens, Mr. Chief Justice, is you get these myriad of cases that we're all familiar with where the court announces it on the record. You get a letter ruling. You get a docket entry. You get all of these. You're getting around to it about reinstating the case. And so the Supreme Court said, and to some extent, maybe it may be a little more form over substance, but I think the policy reasons are what push it over the edge from a policy standpoint of saying, hey, look, it'll be a slippery slope. We know sometimes it may be a different result or something that we're not entirely pleased about if we could pick and choose how we wanted to decide each case. But at some point, they draw the line, say, we've got a rule on it. We've got a specific procedure because, everyone's familiar. So many cases get dismissed and so many cases get DWOPed that if you started creating these exceptions on dismissals and DWOPs, a lot of civil cases get dismissed. You'd have this never-ending reinstatement process. So they drew the line in the sand. Look, we've got to have it specific. We want it express. We want it in writing, and we want it specific. So I don't think the implication of reinstatement applies here. That was reaffirmed by N. Ray Montemayor. And I think what you do see with the Texarkana Court of Appeals, which is a non-published opinion, is you see courts and you know, the case, the Texarkana case is, you know, you read those, that case, and it's really a case of where they just, you know, they tacked the wrong order, and they're really, the case was pretty weak, and they wanted to dispose of it, and I think they did, and so you have that discussion. But we still have the Supreme Court cases out there, and I think that's the first issue. So if the court agrees with our position on that, this case was never reinstated, and the underlying orders are should be reversed.
I'm not suggesting that it would be required since it goes to subject matter jurisdiction, but was this brought to the trial court's attention, this jurisdictional defect?
I don't believe it was. I don't believe it was. There was a lot of things that I was hoping or wished would have been brought to the court because, you know, the way the order was signed on the judgment, the hearing, I had to contemplate raising the issue, but they were going for, you know, different issues that weren't, I didn't have pleadings or documents to support additional arguments.
Well, there's no burden, I don't think, on to raise subject matter jurisdiction.
No, so. I don't believe so.
But it, you know.
I understand. And you know what troubles me about these cases? And Justice Walker, if you recall the case, VLK, that I had in which it was a similar case situation, it's like nothing I've seen in the briefs and nothing I've seen in the trial court below says, why was this case even ever brought? I mean, why, you know, no explanation of why do you wait 8 years for allegedly not being paid child support? And unfortunately, my guy was finally able to get the conclusive documentary evidence of all these close to $100,000, $80,000 worth of payments. You say, you know, is it simply we're going to allege and attach a spreadsheet and say no child support payments for 8 years and make him then go see if he's kept records for 8 years? You know, I do a lot of family law cases, and whenever I instruct my clients, you know, I'm militant about it. You're paying through the child support. I'm going to come break your arm because I get these cases where this comes up. And they've really done a big movement, especially when I started practicing in the early 90s and stuff like that. Almost everybody, a lot of people didn't pay through the registry. And then you went to the local registry, and now they've made it statewide. And so that's all good. And I think everybody's getting towards that place. But still, you know, you get that phone call from the ex-spouse who's ever paying it and says, you know, it takes too long. It's got to go down there. Then it's going to come up here. I need to make the house payment. You know, so we get presented with these situations where they wait 8 years to bring this lawsuit, which then dovetails into the new trial situation, which, you know, crazy facts, you know. Newly discovered evidence. There's the four major elements on the new trial. And the newly discovered evidence is the first issue. And where the two parties have maybe, the appellee's done a good job of saying, you know, hey, you knew you made the payments. And, of course, my client's saying, yeah, I testified to that. I tried to say it. But when you don't have the documentary evidence in front of Judge Bill Harris, you either, you know, try to work something out or you go to jail. To say they raise the issue that my client, Mr. Miles, withheld the documents and didn't produce them, I don't think that's a very logical argument when you look beneath the surface of it, because why on earth would he withhold bank records proving child support payments? I mean, it's not like I've got the smoking gun where, you know, I admit I didn't repair the brakes and there's a truck and, oh, let's hide that document. These are exculpatory documents. And so what they didn't know was in existence was the existence of the documentary proof, which he tried to obtain. The second element is due diligence. We outlined the testimony there of his efforts to try to obtain that. There's also a corollary doctrine of which we cited about when there is fraud, the due diligence element is relaxed. And in this case, certainly we contend that fraud was perpetrated on my client because bringing allegations of 431 non-payments of child support coming into court and saying those payments were not made, when then we've got the conclusive documentary proof that those child support payments were paid. She admits on the stand at the new trial hearing that she did receive some, but she thought they were incorporated. Doesn't explain how she thought they were incorporated or anything along those lines. Once again, I go back to the proposition of, you know, why was this case brought to begin with? Was it the fact that they were betting on the fact that he couldn't find the documents? I don't know. Next issue is cumulative. We certainly don't think the documentary proof is cumulative. It's the business record affidavits trying to prove up the evidence. It's the smoking gun evidence rather than just a swearing match because they weren't made through the child support office. You've got to otherwise show up documentary proof. And, of course, I think it's self-evident that they're absolutely material. When you've got the documents that prove it. And what we don't see in the briefs either is a denial that these are the documentary proof, an allegation that those payments are those, you know, no attack on the underlying documentation. It does get to the fact that they were excluded from evidence mainly on the basis of they weren't produced through discovery. Well, the first rule of production are you supposed to produce documents you have in your possession. So I don't think that exclusion is proper, and I think that's clearly an abuse of discretion on that ruling. Secondly, once again, getting to the motives. I mean, you know, I get the phone call and I hear these things and I talk about it. It's like, you know, my goodness, couldn't you have gotten these documents? You know, would have resolved a lot of this issue. And so withholding them is not something that he did not want to do. He would have it would have helped his position. Side issues of whether it constituted surprise or not. Certainly couldn't have been surprised when she knows she was receiving those child support payments all those years. Also, we do cite to the court the allegations of fraud, that there was a waiver of the rights by accepting the payments in the in the doctrine of estoppel. Waiver and estoppel were not expressly used in the pleadings below. But fraud was, and perjured testimony was, and I thought the pleadings got close enough to, in the underlying pleadings, they certainly in the answer contended that she had received those payments, and it was in her answer. So we think those were before the court. They didn't use the technical words correctly, but it certainly was raised in the pleadings for notice by saying, hey, you got these payments, you got an overpayment, you're seeking a double recovery. So certainly I think those issues were all before the court. If they wanted any clarification, they certainly could have sought a special exceptions to clarify those. We cited to the court the Higgins versus Higgins and the Niles versus Rockwell cases, which, as in any type of situation, in an ordinary contract situation, you can modify the terms or waive your rights under contractual terms. And so by accepting those payments, as I think anybody who would want child support, would accept their child support payments. So we think the requirement that payments only be made through the registry of the court is an issue that could have been not required or waived, or certainly, which was specifically alleged, the result of fraud and perjured testimony. Finally, we cited to the court the policy reasons behind child support, which is obviously for the benefit of the child. It's not a windfall to the other parent, and it's not a double recovery. In this situation, I tend to get these cases sometimes, and trying to right what we perceived as wrong. Certainly, if I was the king, I would have maybe hit my client up for attorney's fees and penalized him for getting documents late, but not to pop him again for another $80,000 of child support, which is devastating to him. We ask the court to reverse the judgments of the trial court.
Are you going to address the appellee's argument that this is not an appealable order on your rebuttal? Or
I did file the petition for writ of mandamus, which has been consolidated into this case.
Okay,
I think primarily I viewed this, and upon reflection, I still think it was primarily the largest part was the money judgment. Of the $103,000 money judgment, which he's ordered to pay, but we also attacked the contempt order itself for holding him in probated contempt by petition for writ of mandamus. And so, if the court were you know, it is a little bit different order, Justice Casey. When I went back and look, it's not your standard type of order. I don't really know how it came about, but I viewed it as a money judgment on the money part.
Is there
in the contempt order as by petition for writ of mandamus. But if the court views the money portion judgment as a contempt order, then we've attacked it by the petition for writ of mandamus as well. So I tried to do the belt and suspenders on that.
Yeah, I don't see anywhere where the court's ordering him to pay the arrearages.
You know, the court.
Maybe I've overlooked it.
One second, I highlighted that.
There's a finding failure to pay.
Right. On page 7, paragraph number 2, current and future child support. He's ordered, in lieu of any other obligation, respondent shall pay to Sherry Miles $700 by cashier's check or money order through the Tarrant County Child Support Office. He says, to the extent necessary, this order modifies the most recent order of the court concerning future payments of child support for any child.
But isn't that an order for future child support?
It is.
Okay.
Current and future.
Okay.
Also on page 4, the court makes a finding that respondent has only paid $10,000 in court ordered child support and is in arrearage in payment of the court ordered child support in the amount of $103,000 through October 16th, which includes statutory interest.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Myers?
May it please the court. Good morning. I must give some deference to my learned opponent because he was not involved in this case when it began. He was only came into the case when the appeal started. So there are a number of things that perhaps he doesn't understand that the record bears out, like why this case was filed and the progression of things that led us here today. first of all, Mr. Chief Justice, this is not an appealable order. I think this court's made that clear. There is no money judgment. This is simply an order of contempt. Every dime that Mr. Miles is ordered to pay pursuant to that order is to keep him out of jail for contempt of the court's order, which is now, or will be 2 weeks from now, a decade old. An order, frankly, that he was in contempt of before it was entered. Mr. Miles was behind, the record will reflect, almost $4,000 in temporary support payments at the time that the court rendered judgment in December of 1999. let me address what I think are the two most salient arguments that my learned opponent makes. The first being the notion that somehow or another the trial court lacked jurisdiction to enter the order that it did in December of last year because there had been a previous order of dismissal entered. And I've got to confess some confusion about how this happens, frankly, because at the time that order of dismissal was entered, there was already, prior to the time that the thing was dismissed, there was already this associate judge's report, which, by the way, Mr. Miles agreed to and signed, which is a part of the record. But apparently that's just the way they do things down there. You know, I felt like that the matter was taken care of. We agreed to an associate judge's report. It was a matter of simply entering the judgment at that point. And I frankly didn't worry about it too much. However, in an abundance of caution, I filed a verified motion to reinstate, which under the rules has the same effect as filing a motion for new trial or a motion to set aside or vacate or reform the court's prior judgment, extends all of the deadlines. And within that time period, the court entered a final judgment.
But doesn't the rule require there to be a hearing? I mean, Rule 165A3 has a specific provision talking about reinstatement, and it says that the trial court shall reinstate the case after a hearing, shall give notice of the time and place of the hearing, and has to make a specific finding that the failure of the party or his attorney was not intentional or the result of conscious indifference.
Yes, Your Honor, there was a hearing. It took place in December of last year. It was a hearing that I set, a hearing that resulted in the entry of the judgment, which is now on appeal. That, in fact, occurred. What the rule says at subpart 4, Your Honor, is that the requirements of that rule are cumulative of other rules and remedies, and all that means to me is that that's not the exclusive way, as we set forth in the brief, that you can, quote-unquote, supersede an order of dismissal. I think where the confusion comes in is that an order of dismissal has been held since it got to be quite in vogue to dismiss cases, which had languished on the court's docket, and I don't argue against the policy of doing so. But the Supreme Court finally made it clear that's a final judgment. I mean, when that happens, you better do something about it. And all of these cases that my learned opponent cites are cases where there was a hearing, as there often is, on a motion to reinstate, and the court says, I'm going to reinstate it, or he makes a docket entry, or she makes a docket entry, as the case may be, and then nothing happens. No superseding judgment is ever entered. Well, that's not what happened in this case. Frankly, a final judgment on the merits is the antithesis of a dismissal motion or a dismissal order. A dismissal order means you didn't prosecute your case.
How do we get around this provision of the rule 165A3 that says, in the event for any reason a motion for reinstatement is not decided by signed written order within 75 days on, the motion is deemed overruled? I mean, it seems pretty express that you have to have a signed written order on the motion to dismiss, because in the event for any reason there's not one, it's deemed overruled.
I would argue that the entry of a final judgment, as in this case, as in the I believe it's Texarkana Court of Appeals case decided, and it is a non-published opinion. However, its logic is inescapable. It says that a summary judgment order in that particular case that was signed post-dismissal superseded the dismissal order. I mean, when they first raised this argument, I thought, you know, that's just one of those things that you're not going to find much law on, because that can't come up much. I mean, my goodness, it just seems so logical to me that if a court enters an order which disposes of the case on the merits, how can that not be an order which supersedes, amends, overrules, modifies, corrects, reforms the prior judgment which would have otherwise gone final? I mean, to me, the logic is inescapable. I understand what the rule says, but the rule also says that the provisions herein are cumulative. To me, that means non-exclusive. We don't have necessarily to have a technical written order that says, okay, the case is reinstated, now I'm going to enter the final judgment.
But I'm thinking, why not? That doesn't seem like it would be that hard if there was actually a hearing.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose if this court decides that that's the law, that we can impose that requirement on trial judges.
I'm not saying I'm imposing anything. I'm saying I think that's what the rule requires.
Well, I think there's a reason why the Supreme Court, when they promulgated the rule, said this is not the only way you can do it. Mm-hmm. I think that probably the rule doesn't contemplate that when something comes up on the dismissal docket, which implies by its very nature that it has languished there for a time, although I'll tell you they're pretty aggressive about it down in these family courts. This case was like 7 months old, I think, when it came up on the dismissal docket and had already been continued once at the request of my opponent. However, I see no reason why that should be another trap for the unwary, when in fact that problem is well solved when a dismissal order comes up and then lawyers using diligence and persuade the court that we should enter a final judgment. We should get this case disposed of, which is the purpose of the rule, I would think. So policy should seem to dictate that in this instance, at least, the rule was complied with substantively, if not, you know, technically in accordance with that rule, at least in the sense that other remedies which are cumulative, that rule is cumulative of, were followed, and that, that result, correct result, was obtained. Mr. Miles raised this defense of payment in his initial pleading. Ms. Miles was a little surprised about that. So Ms. Miles sent him some discovery and said, show me. Give me all evidence of all payments that you have made. And, and she gave him not just one but two opportunities. She said, show me the documents, and two, explain it to me. Here's the interrogatory. Tell me what you mean by this particular contention in your responsive pleadings. He took the fifth. He inexplicably took the fifth. If he had all this evidence, if all of this evidence that he wants to present to the trial court post-judgment are really child support payments, then why in the world didn't he say, as he never did until post-judgment, I have made payments, I just simply don't have documentation of it, give me a little more time and I'll find it. He never said that. I asked him when he was on the stand at the new trial hearing, I said, when did you start looking for these documents? He said, oh, man, you know, when the lawsuit was filed. I said, show me one piece of paper, one email, one letter, one form you filled out, anything at all that would tell this court that you're telling the truth. You knew, didn't you, Mr. Miles, that this was going to be an issue about whether you, in fact, started looking for these documents in a timely fashion when you came here asking the court to set this judgment aside. He said, yes, I knew that. And he said, no, there's not a paper. So there were payments made. My client admitted that. But remember something. At the time that this lawsuit was filed, golly, when was it now? Back in 07, I suppose. The child support office showed that he was behind nearly $140,000. This man simply had not made his child support payments. He admitted on the stand that he had not made his health insurance payments. He admitted that he had not reimbursed my client for unreimbursed medical as he was required to do. He simply didn't do what he was supposed to do. His mother made some payments to my client. And I believe she testified that the grandmother said, well, this is, you know, I'm giving my grandchildren their inheritance early, something of that nature. You can't hide behind the Fifth Amendment. It's his right to avail himself of that. But you can't hide behind it and then come in at the last minute and say, oh, look, here's my evidence. Here's my evidence. I'm not guilty of what you say I'm guilty of. I had no opportunity to cross-examine him about it. I had no opportunity to take his mother's deposition to find out what these things were for. He just shows up at the last minute, never withdrew his assertion of the Fifth Amendment rights under the discovery, and just shows up and says, here, give me a break. You know, the law is pretty clear. You can't do that. And I think that Judge Harris was well within his discretion in not allowing that evidence to come in. First of all, he obviously didn't believe Mr. Miles' story about what these alleged payments were supposedly for, which he was free to do. Trial of the bench, he's the judge of the credibility of the witnesses. He can give it all the weight he wants to, or he can give it none. And he apparently didn't give it much. So I think that, the fairness argument is something that's frankly bothered me for a long time. My learned opponent suggests that my client should somehow be penalized because she waited 8 years post-decree to come in and do something about this guy that wasn't paying her, wasn't supporting his three children. That is not a compelling argument to me. I mean, if he's not paying his child support and she's shouldering the burden for three children alone, how's she going to afford a lawyer? The attorney general's not as efficient as we'd always like for them to be because they're overwhelmed because of folks like Scott Miles that don't pay their child support. There were two easy solutions for Mr. Miles if what he's trying to convince you of is true. One, he makes these payments through the child support office, or two, he keeps records. Those records are easy to keep. You just keep a copy of your checks. If you think there's ever going to be a problem, you keep a copy of your checks. And he didn't do that. He didn't do that, Your Honors, because any payments that he did submit to my client, with the exception of some, which she admitted she got some, and he's given credit for them, were not what he says it is now. Back in October, when we sat down and negotiated this deal, there was no allegation that Mr. Miles had paid 80-something thousand dollars in child support, none whatsoever. We simply sat down and calculated on the basis that the decree, which was written wrong, and it was something that I didn't know because I didn't draw it, but that child support obligation would have ended in 2006. That's the reason that order is written like it is, because the additional $700 is to fix that problem. Because otherwise, this youngest child who just turned 14 wouldn't be getting child support payments going forward. So that was part of the deal, too, and the record bears that out. So all of this business about he didn't understand what he was doing or he had some defense that he was precluded from raising is just simply hogwash. It's just simply not true. The correct result obtained in the trial court, and this court should affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Mr. Michelle. Mr. Michelle, I have a question.
Yes.
You know, there's an axiomatic principle that a trial court always has jurisdiction to enforce its own judgment.
Correct.
Would you agree? Okay. Why would it be wrong to interpret the trial court's action in this case, finding Mr. Miles in contempt? Why would it be wrong to construe that or interpret that as enforcing its own judgment through contempt?
Sure. I think there's a dramatic distinction between your analogy. One is you have your normal civil judgments. If you've got a judgment for $10,000, a trial court is obligated to enforce its judgment, post-judgment discovery, compelling depositions, things of that nature. In this situation, what you have is you have a final decree of divorce. If a proponent is contending that a person has violated that final decree of divorce, how is that enforced? You file a motion for enforcement, just like any other lawsuit. It has pleadings, notice pleadings, opportunities to conduct discovery and defense, like in any normal lawsuit.
So are you saying the filing of the motion to enforce is necessary to trigger the trial court's jurisdiction to enforce its own judgment?
Absolutely. That's been established law. Whenever we do a motion to modify, which is an existing final decree of divorce, it's not an enforcement action, and maybe it's the termination of an enforcement action, but this is governed by family code conduct. Anytime, in fact, 10 years ago, in fact, the district clerk now is changing the cause numbers. You don't even have the same cause numbers. You have to pay a filing fee, a service fee, whether you file a petition to modify the parent-child relationship, that's a new lawsuit with plenary jurisdiction of that. When you file a motion for enforcement, it starts the clock running. There's limitation periods on child support actions. It's not unlimited. There's all types of limitations on those type of things. All procedural due process is applied. Otherwise, if it was simply just enforcing the final decree, you'd have no defenses to it. So all the procedural mechanisms for instituting a lawsuit of enforcement, modifying, any of those natures are all in place, and you govern and look at the rules of civil procedure to the extent they're not preempted by the family code.
Did you research this question, I guess, before submitting this case? I mean, and the question I'm just still struggling with is you say that a motion to enforce is a necessary prerequisite to the trial court having subject matter jurisdiction to enforce its own judgment. I'm just not sure about that. I mean, it's a procedure. It may be a procedural step that needs to be taken. But my question is, I guess, if there's not a motion to enforce, are you saying the trial court has no jurisdiction to enforce its own judgment?
You know, actually, you're asking somewhat of a complicated question because, quite frankly, a trial court may not have subject matter jurisdiction if the child moves. Trial court is divested of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, that's true
So it's not a stone cold rule. Yes, it is dependent upon its subject matter jurisdiction changes and fluxes depending on a variety of situations, where the parties live, where the child lives.
Well, if you can find any cases that, you know, speak to the more general situation that I'm discussing, it would be helpful. Cases that, it doesn't have to necessarily be in family law. It just, you know, just any situation where there's a judgment and the trial court is exercising its jurisdiction to enforce the judgment with or without a motion to enforce, it would just be helpful.
Sure. And if I understand your inquiry correctly,
well, this is where I'm coming from. I'm thinking out loud.
Sure. And I am too. I'm sorry. When I was pausing, I was starting to run through my head all the situations.
I'm just thinking out loud. Why couldn't the trial court enforce its judgment by contempt without somebody filing a motion to enforce? I mean, the court could do that sua sponte, I'm saying, arguably.
I don't think it can.
Question. Can right. I will does say the this, court the have the power code, and jurisdiction to enforce its own judgment sua sponte?
I will say this. I know the family code is very express and has express detailed procedures in Chapter 154 is child support, 156 is modification. I'm thinking maybe it's 155 is enforcements. But it is very express on how you, in order to file a motion enforcement, which I have a number pending right now, you file your motion enforcement. I'm not aware, and I will look at it, Your Honor, but having done this for almost 20 years, I can't think of any sua sponte ability to bring, there's an advocate. Typically, it's either the parent.
Sorry, counsel, it's your time. Or the,
Can I finish up a couple
last? No, you've answered my question, unless the other judges have a question. You've answered mine.
I was going to point you to page 6, if I could.
That's okay. Thank you, counsel. Time's up.
Okay.
Nice try. Okay. Mr. Michelle, Mr. Myers, thank you for appearing here this morning, presenting your arguments. Your case is submitted, and you're both excused.